We will now move on to our next speaker. She is Anita Baksh. Anita Baksh is a doctoral student of Caribbean Literature in the Department of English at the University of Maryland. The topic of her dissertation is Cultural and National Identity in Indo-Caribbean Literature. And she has an article coming out in February 2011 in an anthology edited by Roseanne Kanai. It's the title of the anthology is Bindi, The Multifaceted Lives of Indo-Caribbean Women. And Anita's article is entitled Breaking with Tradition, Border Crossing in Indo-Caribbean Women's Writing. So I'll just let you carry on then, Anita.
Thank you. I'd like to first say thank you to ICSA for accepting my paper and to say that it's an honor to be here participating in a conference with the pioneers of Indo-Caribbean scholarship. My paper is titled Negotiating Identity, Ethnicity, and Nation in Shani Mutu's He Drowned, She in the Sea. Indo-Trinidadian Canadian writer Shani Mutu's debut novel, Sirius Blooms at Night, which was published in 1996, has received much critical attention from within and outside of Caribbean literary circles, particularly because of its treatment of such important themes as Indian indentureship, sexual violence against women, and alternative sexual identities. However, her 2005 novel, He Drowned She in the Sea, has been largely overlooked to date. This text also addresses the theme of identity formation, but focuses on the ways in which ethnicity, class, and migration complicates notions of home and nation. Unlike most Indo-Caribbean literary productions that explore the history of Indians within the Caribbean region, Mutu's novel is one of few that is set in the contemporary moment and that addresses Indo-Caribbean subjectivities out of the Caribbean, as well as outside of a metropolitan space, since the novel is partly set in Vancouver, Canada. It fills gaps in Caribbean literature in its depiction of class division within the Indo-Caribbean community, thereby challenging narratives that homogenize Indians as a singular group, as well as provides a supplementary narrative to the immigrant novel, which usually focuses on the establishment of Caribbean communities and bonds between Caribbean peoples within Western metropolitan spaces. So perhaps the best known of this is Sullivan's Lonely Londoners. He Drowned She in the Sea depicts characters that migrate from the Caribbean to Canada, from Canada back to the Caribbean, and lastly from the Caribbean to Honduras, moves that require them to navigate identity and belonging in the context of racial and cultural landscapes of first world and third world spaces. In this paper, I would like to investigate the ways in which the novel explores the formation of ethnic and national identities. How are Indo-Caribbean identities negotiated within the Caribbean and abroad, a condition Stuart Hall terms as being twice diasporized? How do ethnicity, class, and gender intersect with national identity? I will begin with a brief summary of the novel, then proceed to a discussion of the way in which ethnic identity is constructed within the Caribbean, and then I examine how national identity is negotiated within Canada. I argue that Mutu employs the common trope of woman as the embodiment of ethnic and national community, seen in many colonial and post-colonial culture productions as a means by which the male protagonist, Harry, attempts to gain access to dominant ethnic and national groups. In the end, the motif disintegrates, signaling the need for new methods of identity construction that transcend ethnic, class, and national binaries. I will conclude by offering Gleason's notion of worldness as one such method. Mutu crafts her novel in the romance genre in order to explore these significant issues, oscillating between a fictionalized Caribbean island, Guanacaste, and Vancouver, as well as between the period of the 1940s and the contemporary moment. He Drowned She in the Sea depicts the story of two childhood friends, Harry St. George and Rose Sanga, who are divided by the rigid class structure of their Caribbean society. Harry is the son of a domestic worker, and Rose is the daughter of a powerful businessman who employs Harry's mother as a laundress. Their friendship is severed by Mr. Sanga, who becomes infuriated after finding the children sleeping beside one another. As a result, he expels Harry and his mother from their home. Consequently, from this early moment of their formative years, the children are indoctrinated into the restrictive patriarchal and class division of their Indo-Caribbean community. The novel ends with the lovers reuniting, but their love requires a distancing of all previous relationships and material possessions. their new beginning is appropriately symbolized in the couple's transit to Honduras over water. The novel calls attention to the ways in which ethnicity and class are used to divide and mask commonalities and share histories between various groups in the Caribbean through its juxtaposition of Harry's relations with his adopted African grandparents and those with the Sangha family. As an Indo-Caribbean subject who is born and raised in a British colony, Harry's ethnic identity becomes a creolized one based on a mixture of Indian, European, and African cultures that exist in Guanagaspar. His parents, Dali and Sudat, are the descendants of Indian indentured servants who were imported to work on the sugar plantations in the Caribbean after the abolishment of slavery. Despite the Indian community's struggle to keep their Indianness and their intentional isolation from Afro-Caribbeans, cultural exchange between the two groups is inevitable, as evident in the experience of Harry's, and this is a quote, "more African than Indian, Indian," end quote, father. Sudat is an orphan who is found in the village of Raleigh by a black couple, Tanti Eugenie and Uncle Mako. As the only Indian that lives in a predominantly African fishing village, Sudat absorbs what is considered by Indians to be African mannerism. The third-person omniscient narrator reveals that as a young girl, Dali was attracted to Sudat because he was, this quote, "was brazen more like black people. Dali would tell her son with delight and pride. He was brazen for so. The way he looked you straight in your face, in your eyes, when he was talking to you, brazenness was a sign of craziness or don't careness, an attribute of black people, not of Indian people," end quote. This brief quote reveals the way Harry's creolized identity comes into being. Although Sudat dies when Harry was a young boy, his hybrid characteristics are passed down to Harry indirectly through stories and directly through the relationship that Harry maintains with his adopted Afro-Caribbean grandparents and through his experience of growing up in two worlds, the Afro-Caribbean village of Raleigh and the Indo-Caribbean town of Marion, where Rose lives. This creolized identity does not require Harry's Indo-Caribbean heritage and his adoption of Afro-Caribbean culture to be mutually diluted, but as theorist Edward Glisson claims, in regard to the process of creolization, it is based on, quote, consensual, not imposed sharing, end quote, of the two traditions. In this way, Harry and his parents transcend the negative colonial stereotypes that create divisions between African and Indian groups in their close ties with Tante Eugenie and Uncle Mako, a bond that is strengthened by their shared working class or poor background. While Harry's openness to cultural mixing with individuals unlike himself and his status as a son of a domestic worker allows him to connect with Afro-Caribbeans, these same characteristics prevent him from becoming romantically involved with Rose. From a young age, Rose is socialized into Indian middle-class values and their patriarchal biases. While growing up, Rose witnesses her mother's confinement to the domestic sphere and her silent suffering as Mr. Sangha keeps a mistress. In a similar manner, Rose marries an Indian of her own class, Shem Bihar, who repeats the unfaithfulness and controlling ways of Mr. Sangha. In this manner, Rose's marriage continues the cycle of male privilege typical of her mother's generation. In her depiction of Rose's marriage to Shem, Mutu employs the recurring trope of post-colonial literature and discourse of women as protectors and reproducers of ethnic and national boundaries. Since control over women's sexuality is central to the maintenance of power, Rose's marriage to Shem becomes important in securing the power of both Shem's and Rose's family, as well as perpetuating the status of the Indian middle class, whose power rests in maintaining the status quo. Hence, when Rose's father separates Harry and Rose as children, who are innocently sleeping next to each other, he attempts to police his daughter's sexuality, sending a clear message that she must stay within her own class background, and he, not she, would choose a suitable partner. Read in this way, Harry's desire for Rose becomes twofold. She's not only the woman he loves, but is also one who will grant him access to middle-class recognition and privilege. So somewhat unlike Naipaul's Mr. Biswas, who attempts to move away from Indian middle class, here we have a character who tries to marry into it. In the novel, this point is made most aptly by Harry's mother, who scolds him for wanting to acquire wealth in order to gain acknowledgement from middle-class circles. Dolly says, quote, "It's not business you're interested in one bit. It's that Sangha family that have you stupid. And another thing, when will you learn, child, that is not the girl you're interested in, but her father and that boy in your class, which is Shem, who like to taunt you so?" End quote. For Harry, a relationship with Rose would give him the one thing that no amount of wealth could, validation in the eyes of men like Mr. Sangha and Shem. Given that control over women's sexuality is crucial in maintaining and destabilizing ethnic class insularity, Rose becomes a prize to be coveted in a game of male power and privilege. This trope of woman as preserver and embodiment of the borders of group identity reappears in the novel in Canada, to where Harry migrates in order to avoid the racial and political turmoil in Guanacaste brought on during and after independence. And Dr. Beer Bosling talked a lot about that. It is important to note that since Harry lives in a colony and he leaves at the brink of its independence, for the most part, his national identity is not a central concern in the novel until he migrates to Canada. There he's able to obtain the class mobility that he was barred from in Guanacaste, but his sense of self is complicated in other ways. The concept of national belonging emerges in the text when Harry embarks on a canoeing trip in the mountains with his white Canadian friend, Kay, who's actually female. As he journeyed up the mountains, this is a quote from the text, pride coursed through him. He has become an insider. By inviting him up, Kay was showing him something few people like him, he grinned at the thought, ever had the chance to see, to glimpse. This was the Canada of postcards and tourism posters. In reality, it was his backyard. He wanted to get out of the truck and look around, but that had the sensation, terror really, that at any time the road would slip away. He took in the vista, a picture straight of a calendar. End quote. The quoted passage clearly demonstrates Harry's desire to become an insider and to attain Canadian national identity. However, this desire simultaneously calls attention to his status as an outsider, as a Caribbean migrant, and person of color. While the terror he feels reflects his physical position on a mountain and the potential of bodily harm, it also signals his fear that this insider status can easily slip away. As Sri Lankan Canadian author Shyam Salvadurai claims, quote, "For the majority of people, a dual identity is a burden forced on them by the fact that their bodies, or their skins to be precise, do not represent the nation state they are in, thus compelling them to constantly wear their difference on their sleeve and carry it around on their back," end quote. As an Indo-Trinidadian immigrant, actually it's an Indo-Guanacastean immigrant, but the fictional island is obviously based on Trinidad, I apologize. Harry's claim to Canadian national identity constantly needs to be validated to others and to himself because his brown skin betrays the common images of white Canadian citizens. Additionally, the scene draws attention to the performative aspect of national identity. Kay comments that Harry's lack of experience canoeing makes him, quote, "not very Canadian," end quote, suggesting that Harry's national identity rests on his ability to perform Canadianness properly. He resolves that after this canoeing trip, he would make another trip like this. Then, quote, he could say that he did this sort of thing, or used to at any rate. Yes, it would be very Canadian of him to be able to say that he used to get up early in the mornings, drive to a lake high up, awfully high up, in the mountains, and go canoeing, end quote. While Harry may be a naturalized Canadian citizen, he would only be accepted as a citizen through the performance and repetition of certain behaviors associated with this brand of Canadian national identity. Lastly, the quote demonstrates that it is through his relationship with a white woman, Kay, that this sense of Canadianness becomes available to Harry. On another occasion, Harry proudly asks himself, quote, "What would his friend Anil say if he knew she, this white woman, the liquor store lady that they teased him about, was thinking of him?" End quote. Kay validates Harry's claim to Canadianness. The narrator goes on to say, Cool. Although this woman is from up here, and well, white skin is the best way he could put it, she is perhaps more like he is than he is like his Indo-Guanagasparian Rose, end quote. As Harry recognizes, he and Kay are able to connect through their shared class experience as self-made individuals who, in stark contrast to Rose, has had to work hard to attain their middle-class lifestyle. In this way, their lived experiences make them more similar than Harry and Rose, who are of the same ethnic background. Yet their love story remains unwritten as Harry's past, particularly his relationship with Rose, returns to haunt him and causes him to return to the Caribbean. By the end of the novel, Harry and Rose pursue their relationship and gain, in Rose's words, a fresh start. After rejecting the restrictive binaries in both Guanagaspar and Canada, Rose subverts her role as a middle-class housewife by staging her death in order to escape her oppressive husband and to be with Harry. In this manner, Mutu presents a post-colonial feminist revision of the trope of woman as symbolic of ethnic and national identity. Rose's decision to live for herself causes the metaphor to disintegrate and severs its regeneration, thereby suggesting the need for new paradigms for constructing post-colonial identity that subverts essential notions of ethnic class and national citizenship. Ultimately, Harry, and in a different way, Rose, give up their struggle to be seen by the middle-class Indian community, and instead, they see each other through a relationship of mutual love and respect. Consequently, the novel suggests that human relationships present a bottom-up approach through which oppression can be combated versus a top-down approach that often does not translate into everyday practice. This strategy is also presented in Sirius Blooms at Night. Between Mala, a victim of incest that becomes mentally ill, and her queer nurse, Tyler, who are both ostracized from their Caribbean community, but find the strength to overcome their marginalization through friendship. But unlike Mala and Tyler, Harry and Rose cannot remain in their Caribbean home because of the political consequences spurred by their relationship. Neither can they return to Canada because Shem will track them down. The novel closes with Harry and Rose attempting to migrate into Honduras with fixed-up papers. In its depiction of ethnic and national identity formation, He Drowns You in the Sea presents a possibility of the existence of multiple identities within one body, illustrating what Gleason terms as worldness and a poetics of relation. Gleason argued that in order to fully recognize and appreciate the diversity of our world, we must admit that our identities transform through our exchanges with each other, not simply acknowledge our differences. The foundation of this theory is the notion of a poetics of relation, where identity is defined in relation to rather than in opposition to the other. It does not promote essentialism or assimilation, but embraces creolization, quote, not merely as encounter, a mestizaje, but a new and original dimension allowing each person to be there and elsewhere, rooted and open, lost in the mountains and free beneath the sea, in harmony and in errantry, end quote. The inability of certain groups to recognize the fluidity of culture and identity, as evident in the novel with the Indian middle-class community, has led to discriminatory practices throughout the world as groups continue for space and power. Gleason views fiction as a significant tool to combat these purist ideologies, since all people share literature, despite differences in technology and politics. He goes on to say that authors must be, quote, sensitive to the totality of the world, end quote, and demonstrate in their work how one place connects to other places. In the novel, Harry embodies this notion of worldness and constructs identity based on a poetics of relation, moving in and out of different circles of people and in and out of different national spaces, refashioning himself based on his location. In this way, He Drowns You in the Sea presents a model of how one can negotiate identity in an ever-changing world and forces us to evaluate our own positions as national subjects in a global community. Thank you.